This is Ian Hampton, recorded at the Hope Bay Reunion in Coniston by Chris Eldon Lee on the 21st of October 2009. Ian Hampton, Part 1.
My name is Ian Hampton. I was born in King's Lynn in Norfolk, 3rd of March 1936.
And your education, Ian, what was it like?
Well, I was one of the first generation to benefit from the Education Act in the mid-40s. So I had the opportunity to win a scholarship to go to grammar school, which I did. I went to King Edward VII Grammar School in King's Lynn. But after a year, my father, who was in the post office, got a job as postmaster of a village of Whitchurch in Hampshire. So we moved there, and I moved to Peter Simmons School in Winchester, where I spent the rest of my school career until I was 19, when I got a county major scholarship, which allowed me to go to university. And I went to University College London, where I graduated in 1958 with an honours degree in physiology.
How did medicine enter your life? What made you? What was the first inkling that you might end up being a medical man?
Well, only paramedical. I mean, I'm not a medical doctor. It's an interesting question, and
sorry,
because I've asked myself it many times. It's strange. All my relatives of my generation, on my father's side, have all ended up in medicine or paramedical sciences. You know, doctors, dentists, physiotherapists, dental hygienists, and so on. Every single one. But of course, we're all of similar ages, so there couldn't have been much influence of one on the other. That's just a coincidence. I had one cousin who was considerably older than me, about 6 years older, and he won a scholarship to read medicine at Edinburgh University. So, I mean, that was a start. Then when the time came for me, it was assumed that I would go to university. I mean, partly because my father wanted me to follow my cousin, and at the school it was just assumed that you either went to university or you went into the church or you went into the military. So what I read at university was largely a matter of elimination of various things. Medicine was the obvious thing, but I ruled myself out of that for two reasons. One was Oxford and Cambridge required you to have four subjects at higher level, and I was taking biology as a combined subject rather than botany and zoology, and one also had to have Latin. And because of my change in school in earlier years, where the regimes were different, I dropped out of Latin, because at Peter Simmons, Latin was studied from age 11, whereas at King Edward School, it had been studied from age 12, and I never caught up. So Oxford and Cambridge was out, and then it was a question of looking around for somewhere else. And I didn't fancy any of the provincial universities, so London was the obvious choice. Meanwhile, there was the question of subject, and I wrote to the MRC, the Medical Research Council, for their annual report, because I was interested in biology of the sciences and sort of quite liked the idea of human biology. And the sections in there which interested me were to do with clinical science, and I thought there might be a route as a non-medic into clinical science. And on writing round, there are only three universities that offered physiology as a single subject degree. One was Glasgow, and I didn't want to go to Scotland. One was Birmingham, and I didn't want to go to a red brick. And the other was University College London, which is where I applied and where I was accepted, and really, without me knowing, into one of the finest departments in the world. I was really, really very lucky. So I ended up at University College. Everything progressed from there. I mean, that's my academic career, really. I mean, finishes up with a PhD, of course, after FIDS, but maybe we'll come on to that later on.
So what was your first brush with the Antarctic? How did you first become aware of its existence, so to speak?
Well, there's a short answer and a long answer.
We have time.
I mean, I've often asked myself, you know, how ever I became involved in the Antarctic. And when I was down there in the beginning, I used to say to myself, why on earth am I here?
Well, that's
without
a moment of great distress.
Well, I don't think it was distress. It was just a reaction to things which were completely strange. I was a simple country boy. Even though I'd spent 3 years in London, it was as an undergraduate and living in a hall of residence and hadn't really had to fight for existence or anything like that. It had all been fairly plain sailing. And suddenly life was fairly raw, both physically and socially and emotionally and so on. Yeah, it did make me wonder. But, well, I'll start with a long answer. We got very little guidance at school about how we should prepare ourselves for the interviews, for the scholarships and entrance to examination, entrance to the college. But one thing that was said was that they'd probably ask us about books that we'd read. And it just so happened that Everest had just been climbed, and I had read, out of interest, The Ascent of Everest. What I didn't know until later was on the interviewing committee of Hampshire County Council was a man named Jack Longland, who was Director of Education, Derbyshire County Council, but had also been on several Everest expeditions in the 30s. And so he immediately seized on this and within a second had revealed the extent of my lack of knowledge. But he was very kind. So that was the beginning of the outdoor world. Then I went I was in a hall of residence, and my roommate was a boy from Leeds who as a family had been very interested in the outdoor world, hill walking, rudiments of rock climbing and so on. And he encouraged me and a few other friends to go on an outdoor pursuits course at Plasty Brennan in North Wales, which we did. I really quite enjoyed that, although I was scared stiff by the climbing. And during the first year at university, I became aware that the undergraduates had an exploration society and they were sending an expedition to the Arctic. And I was quite interested in that, and I made one or two inquiries. But they were not interested in me. I had nothing to offer. I had no experience or anything like that. So that was that. But the second year, I discovered that that expedition hadn't finished its work and was going back for a second year to finish up. This time, the organiser was a close friend in the Hall of Residence and actually lived near me in Hampshire and so on. And I went along to him and said, who was it? A man named McNaish. He became a teacher and then Department of Education.
So you got a place?
I did eventually, but in a roundabout sort of way. I asked him and he said, the problem is, Ian, you've got nothing to offer. I'd go and prepare the meals and wash the pots and pans and so on. He said, no, you know, we've got to have somebody who can make a contribution. And I was a bit despondent about that. But actually, at university at that time, we were having a course of lectures in human applied physiology that was given by a man named Harold Lewis, who was a senior scientist in the Division of Human Physiology at the Medical Research Council, and who happened just to have been on an Arctic expedition, the British North Greenland expedition, where he'd done quite a lot of research. And I thought, perhaps he could help me, so I plucked up courage to phone him. And he was very welcoming. He said, yes, you know, well, I'd like to meet you. Please come up to the Division of Human Physiology, which is Hampstead, and meet the people there, and we can talk about it and so on. And so I did that. And the Medical Research Council, who worked very closely with the Army Personnel Research Establishment, that's the where all the Army physiology was done, they were based in Farnborough, I think. They were doing what became quite a famous study on energy balance in Sandhurst recruits. And I was introduced to the senior Army physiologist, whose secretary I later married, but and he said, oh yes, he said, we can fit you up with something. And so we had a talk about what we might do and, you know, what it might cost and where I'd get the equipment from. And so I think, you know, I went to my friend and said, you know, I've got the beginnings of a program. And he said, oh well, yes, well, that, you know, sounds good, I'll bear it in mind. Then about a few days later, I was summoned by the head of department, with Professor Sir Lindor Brown, a very austere man, Foreign Secretary of the Royal Society. And he said to me, he said, what have you been getting up to, Hampton? What are you getting involved in? You know, so I told him all about it. And he said, that sounds a very good idea. He said, I'd like to see you pursue that. He said, what about money? And so I said, well, I don't really know. I mean, I can't afford very much, you know, and I don't know. I've not been asked for any money. He said, how about £50? He said, the department will support you to the extent of £50. Well, in 1957, that was quite a lot of money. I mean, the whole expedition only cost £800, I think. So I then went to see my friend and I said, look, I've got a programme backed by the Medical Research Council. I've got £50 from the department. What about it now? Dear boy, he said, welcome aboard. So I went on the expedition and the prof said, you really must make use of this. He said, I would encourage you to write it up and present it as part of your practical work in finals next year, which is what I did. And I spent about a day a week, I suppose, at the Medical Research Council in my third year, working out results and getting help and so on. And I was having lunch with this chap, Harold Lewis, one day, and he said, you graduate this year, don't you? He said, what are you going to do when you graduate? I didn't know, but as I said earlier, physiology department at University College was renowned for its neurophysiology, and I thought I'd become a neurophysiologist, and I'd, you know, had one or two provisional approaches. And he said, "What about the Antarctic? Ever thought about that?"
Who's been there?
No. I'll explain why. The Division of Human Physiology at Hampstead was where all the FIDS doctors were trained. And I mean, they were not only advised on what medical expertise they needed to brush up on, but the assumption was they wouldn't actually have much medicine to do, and so they'd have time on their hands. And they ought to do a bit of research. So, you know, they had some experience in devising medically oriented research programs for the Antarctic. Now, just to step aside for one moment, in this area of applied human physiology in relation to the environment, the way that man adapts to hot climates was by that time fairly well established. But despite many investigations into responses to cold, there'd been no real consensus. So it was an open question as to how it might happen. And one idea that they at the MRC had was that, you know, even though technology and clothing and so on was fairly primitive, maybe that man managed to protect himself to such an extent that they were never really cold. People were never really cold. Although anybody who's been to the Antarctic or the Arctic knows that that's a no-brainer. But I mean, that's what they thought. And so they thought it would be a good idea to have somebody whose prime objective was to assess exposure to cold. And they asked me if I would like to do that. And I was a bit taken aback, you know. I mean, it was a big thing, and I mean, I didn't answer straight away, and I thought about it for quite a long time. But in the end, I thought, you know, well, it's an opportunity. It's not going to occur again, I'm sure. I better, you know, either decide yes or no now. So I decided yes, but I did decide that what they had asked me to do on its own was a bit boring. I mean, because, you know, scientists are experimentalists, and this was just recording, it was not experimenting. And so I said yes, but could I add in some experiments? And they said yes, and, you know, please do. And it just so happened that one of my, one of Neil Orr's predecessors at Hope Bay, a doctor named Paul Massey, you may have heard about, had done some very simple experiments on the sensitivity of the fingers following cold stress, and had shown that there was some adaptation, that when you first went into the cold, your fingers became very numb. But in about the first 6 weeks of residence there, your feeling returned. And I thought that it would be quite interesting to see whether that had a basis in blood flow changes. So I proposed that I should do that, and they said that was fine. Except...
They being the MRC?
Yes, the MRC, that's right. Except that they advised me to try and measure blood flow. They didn't really think was an experimental technique that would lend itself to an Antarctic environment until I was more experienced. So they suggested that I should measure heat loss from the hands by calorimetry. And so that's what I did. I mean, I had some help in building a calorimeter, as well as, you know, making all the things for the exposure study, and, you know, that's how the program was set up.
Were there any factors which made you think twice about going to the Antarctic?
Well, only what I've mentioned, really. I mean, it was quite an extreme suggestion. I mean, I'd not had any background, which made it a natural progression. But I think, you know, one thing about my life is that, I mean, looking back on it, I've had a number of opportunities, and I've taken all of them, and they've all, you know, turned out okay.
So the fate of Scott and Oates and Co. didn't worry you at all?
Not very much, no. No, I mean, I didn't know too much about them, to be quite honest. No. I never felt that. There was any particular danger that I would...
You didn't worry about it?
I didn't worry about it, no.
So having got the MRC sewn up, so to speak, how did you actually... Who or how did you persuade FIDS to take you on?
Ah, well, no, the MRC did that, you see. I mean, I didn't even apply for the job. there was a fairly delicate relationship, I think, between the FIDS, and particularly Bunny Fuchs, and the MRC. I mean, I don't know what people have said to you about Bunny Fuchs.
What's your view on that?
Well, I'd like to quote somebody else, a colleague of mine from the Medical Research Council, who was on the Transantarctic expedition, who described Bunny Fuchs as an overgrown Boy Scout. And I don't think Fuchs spoke to him for 30 years. But I would actually go along with that. I think a lot of Fuchs' attitudes were quite immature towards science and exploration and so on. He was an heroic, a bit like Scott. You know, you went out with your sledge wheel and compass and you did these traverses and you took theodolite sites and so on, and you made maps, and your geologist got out his hammer and chipped off a few samples to take back for analysis in London. But you know, in the 1950s, I think science was entering a different era of precision and quantification and so on, and Fuchs didn't seem to take that on somehow. You know, life in the Antarctic was one of hardship which had to be overcome by fortitude and endurance and so on, not by having, you know, well-designed clothes and you know, all of that sort of thing. And so I think there had been a bit of a relationship like that between Bunny Fuchs and Otto Edholm, who was the head of the Division of Human Physiology. But, I mean, he had got the backing of the Medical Research Council. He got the whole of the Medical Research Council behind him on this. And they did train the FIDS doctors. And I suppose the question arose that if Medical Research Council didn't do it, who else would?
So Fuchs was snookered, was he?
In essence, yes, but I think that's a stronger word than I would use.
Was he a charismatic, overgrown Boy Scout?
I think it depends who you are. I think a lot of people saw him like that. I didn't. I didn't think he was a good director.
Mm. I mean, just to push that one step further, and please, you know, if you can't answer, please say so. Would you say that the view of Fuchs from the medical profession or the scientific world was different to the view of Fuchs from the exploratory world?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think that, you know, Fuchs thought that men were weak, really, you know, and you know, they had to summon up the courage to do all of these various things. And I mean, he was interested in and had knowledge of field sciences, and so experimental laboratory work, particularly of a biological kind and a human kind, was quite strange to him, and I don't think he really took it on board.
So does that mean that you were going under sufferance, or were you actually welcomed?
By whom?
By FIDS generally.
Oh, I think I was welcomed, yes. Mm. Yes. Oh, yes. I don't have any complaints. I'm just telling my feelings of what the background was.
This is a very valuable thing. Mm-hmm. So tell me about how you got there and what happened when you got there. First of all, you had to, as you say, gather all your materials and your equipment.
Yes.
This was a bit rudimentary.
Yes, it was very simple apparatus because, you know, Harold Lewis had experience of the Arctic and North Greenland, and he'd been there for 2 years. And so he had lots of practical advice, and we did try and keep things as simple as possible. And I mean, one of the things that I was advised was that you'll find it very difficult to use a pencil and paper when you're out in the field. And so why don't we think about some automatic recording device? And so I bought not a tape recorder, because miniature tape recorders weren't available then, but a wire recorder. I mean, that I can't remember how many hours recording it had, but I mean, the reels were like that, and the thing was so I could just tuck in my pocket.
About the size of a video cassette.
Yes. Yeah. And the idea was that I could read my instruments with gloves on, and then I would dictate my readings into this wire recorder and then transcribe them at night time. Good idea. Tested it out, in this country, and it really worked very well, but failed the first day in the Antarctic. Now, I don't know whether it was the cold or whatever it was, but the taking up spool didn't revolve. And so when I got into the tent at night and I opened my recorder, it was a mass of stainless steel wires sprang out like that, rather like a pot scrubber. So, that was no good. I mean, I just did have to use pencil and paper, which did impose quite a few restrictions, really. But there we are. Yeah.
So all right, we're leaving about a bit, but that's fine. Whilst we're on that area, just tell me about the kind of tests or experiments you were doing on people. What measurements, what readings were you taking?
Well, for this human exposure study, I was first of all recording activity. Well, starting at the very simplest level, if at the time of the recording the person was inside or outside, what they were doing on a scale of 1 to 7.
In terms of energy expenditure?
Yeah, yes, well, of activity. I mean, what I transcribed to energy expenditure later. And then I was measuring surrounding meteorological conditions, temperatures and wind velocity. And then I was measuring various temperatures, skin temperatures, and deep body temperatures via rectal temperature. And one of the things that I learned quite early on was that it was going to be quite difficult to do this on my colleagues. I mean, as I'd planned, a nice experimental design devised in a laboratory in England just wasn't going to work in the Antarctic. So I restricted those studies to myself, because I could always control and adapt what I was doing to the needs of the experiment.
So FIDS didn't like thermometers up their rectums?
On the whole, it was not popular. No. But it wasn't just that. I mean, that was the crucial point, of course. But it meant a great deal of interfering with what they were doing. Do you mind stopping whilst I read all these temperatures and so on? So I just studied myself, and over the 2 years I managed to get, I think it was about 45 days of recordings, which was much less than I had hoped, but in the circumstances I think was not bad. And the experiments were conducted in base, and rather than having to set up some kind of temperature controlled room in which to do it, I made the measurements on the people when they were still in bed after a night's sleep, the rationale being that they would choose their bed environment to be comfortable for them. And that was about as stable a baseline as I was likely to get. And the actual measurements themselves were really very simple. I filled these calorimeters with water. I had two sets of experiments at two different temperatures. The subjects then immersed their hands to a fixed level, and I measured the temperature change. And from the temperature change, and knowing the mass of water and so on, I could calculate heat transfer between hand and water. So it was very simple, but had some quite interesting results. And I did this on, I think, altogether about seven or eight people. And they were very cooperative. And in fact, after we came back to England, they all came to my flat in Hampstead so that I could do some final sort of winding up measurements. And I was quite pleased with that.
So what kind of conclusions were you coming to, Ian? Like, presumably your conclusions came later back at the MRC.
What, from the experiments, you mean? Well, I think the temperature results showed that by objective standards, people did get jolly cold. And then we think there was no doubt about that. You know, on the fingers, temperatures went down to near freezing, and that's cold by anybody's standards. And on occasions, rectal temperature went down very low indeed. And from my subsequent experience, some 20 years later, we're entering into hypothermia.
On a regular basis?
No. Well, I can't tell about the days when I didn't measure. Mm. But on one day when I was making measurements, and I remember it very clearly, I stopped recording on myself because I just couldn't carry on. And my deep body temperature at that time was 35. We'd been doing a depot run from Cape Lackman to View Point. I was travelling with Mike Rhodes, and he got a tummy upset and just couldn't do any activity. He couldn't run by the sledge or push by the sledge because otherwise he messed his pants. So he spent most of the time sitting on the sledge, and I had to do the running and the pushing and so on, and it was about 20-odd miles. And so when we got to View Point, I was exhausted, and I was really cold. And I didn't stop shivering for 6 hours. Everybody else went about the normal sort of activities in the hut, and I just crawled into bed and just lay there whilst they brought me cups of tea and so on and warmed me up. But I mean, that, so people did get cold. I think there was no doubt about that. The other side of things, the experimental side of things, there's a phenomenon in the human hands, all parts of the body, but it's mostly noticed in the hand, called cold-induced vasodilatation. And when I was a small boy, in the winter time, we used to play snowballs with bare hands because we couldn't afford any gloves. I can remember from that time that it was dreadful to begin with, but after you'd been doing it for maybe 20 minutes or half an hour, your hands glowed and you just didn't feel the cold. And I know now that was an expression of this cold-induced vasodilatation. And a lot of the work, scientific work, that had been done in this field on people like Eskimos, Arctic Indians, Arctic fishermen and so on, had suggested that these people were more susceptible to cold-induced vasodilatation than were the controlled subjects. And so it was thought that this was the adaptive response to cold. But it had never actually been measured in people who were progressing into a cold environment and who might show signs of acclimatization. It had never been demonstrated in terms of blood flow or heat flow or anything like that. So my experiments were quite interesting. The problem was that when I came to work out the results, they produced the opposite result. I showed definite signs of changes, but blood flow reduced rather than increased. And My boss at the MRC, Otto Edholm, he just wrote it off. He just said, well, that's not possible. Everybody knows that blood flow increases
in the cold.
That's what he said. Mine quite clearly showed the opposite. Exposure studies that I'd done showed that finger temperatures did reach levels which might be expected to provoke this response. But my conclusion was that actually they weren't cold enough. The temperatures weren't cold enough, and that what they were doing was stimulating the normal response to cold that you and I experience here when we go outside, you know, get vasoconstriction in the fingers, and that going to a cold climate like the Antarctic, the acclimatization process enhances that, in which case it's an exact mirror image of what happens in the heat, the results of which everybody knew and accepted. You know, blood flow increases, you begin sweating and so on as a result of being in the heat. And here was I was showing that the opposite thing was happening in the cold, but nobody believed it because you know, everybody knows that Eskimos have excess blood flow. So, you know, that's a summary of the results in a nutshell. And I mean, it was really quite difficult to get support for publication of these results, and I mean, I eventually did it by presenting them at a conference in America, where it was more or less accepted that your written version of that paper would be published in the Federation proceedings. So you know, I got around it that way.
You're making medical history.
Well, only in the same way that anybody who does research makes history. I mean, if you show something that hasn't been shown before, I mean, that's history.
Did that have any relationship to frostbite problems? Would that in any way illustrate why frostbite happens?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think frostbite happens because the exposed part, I mean, just gets cold and freezes. The stimulus. Well,
If the cold had made blood circulation greater, that would have combated frostbite.
Yeah, right. Well, this is my theory, which I haven't published because I've never found a suitable vehicle for doing so. I think that this cold induced vasodilatation, which I mentioned earlier, is not a physiological response to cold, but a pathological response to cold. And eventually, I mean, if the cold stimulus is extreme enough and is overwhelmed, then the tissues just freeze. I mean, they can't sustain it. And the increased blood flow comes from damaged blood vessels, not from natural blood vessels responding naturally to cold. And I mean, jumping ahead some 20 years later, I went on another expedition to the Antarctic, and I was able to do this exposure work much more carefully and in a much more sophisticated sort of way. And you know, the main conclusions which I'd come to were substantiated that you know, there's no, in normal life, people in the Antarctic, there is no measurable sign of cold-induced vasodilatation. It's all vasoconstriction. And we also did some more sophisticated blood flow studies. We actually measured blood flow and heat flow at the same time. And those results confirmed what we deduced from the temperature measurements. And also suggested that another interesting thing was happening, which was that there was an increased transfer of heat from arteries to veins before the blood actually reaches the periphery, maybe in the lower or upper arm and so on, which is called, well, via blood vessels, which are called arteriovenous anastomoses. And that, again, had not been shown before. So, you know, it did I think I was right in the first instance.
But that was a conclusion 20 years later, in the 1980s?
Yes, yes.
You went again to the Antarctic?
Yes, 1980. Mm.
Okay, I'll come back to that for me in due course. Let's go back then to your first trip to Hope Bay at the turn of the 60s. Mm. And everybody I've spoken to has talked about the Ian Hampton crevasse rescue.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Except you. So, in a nutshell, what was your... What memories do you have? I appreciate that perhaps you have the least memory.
Yes, I do, really. Because, I mean, firstly, just after it happened, I was pretty dazed. I must have had a severe blow to the head because I had this large laceration on the scalp. And I subsequently developed a Bell's palsy. I was paralysed all down this side of the face, so I probably was hit here on the facial nerve. And I was all...
ear and the eye.
Yeah. And I was also leaking cerebrospinal fluid from this ear, so presumably, well, my eardrum had burst. I had an X-ray when I got back to Stanley some months later, and the doctor said, well, the evidence suggests that you may have fractured your skull, but we can't be certain about it. So there was that. And then the other injury was the dislocation of the left elbow. What I remember, I suffered retrospective amnesia. I mean, most people do after something traumatic like this. So the last thing that I remember was being aware that the dogs were running over a crevasse because they shied away sharply to the left, which meant that the crevasse, they were running along the edge of the crevasse, and so I needed to whip them through 90 degrees to make them go across the crevasse, which I did. And then I put my... we were coming down quite a steep glacier. I mean, so there was no effort involved. And I was standing on the back of the sledge when this happened. And I then put my foot on the ground to wheel the sledge round. And I think my foot went through the lid of the crevasse. And then the lid collapsed. And that's the last thing I remember, putting my foot on the crevasse. The next thing that I remember is sitting, I think, in this sort of bluish-black cavern with a light hole up above. And I don't think I actually remember seeing Chris Brading's head looking down, but that's what my memory is. Chris Brading saying, "Are you all right?"
What was your reply?
Well, he said I was. I mean, he said that I said
right.
I was all right. I mean, he would justify that by what happened next was that he sent down a rope with a loop on it. And as I remember it, I clipped it into the carabiner, which was on my chest harness. And then subsequently, they pulled me up. I mean, there must have been a considerable passage of time, although I don't remember that. The only thing that I remember about being pulled up is that the rope was dislodging snow from the crevasse lid, and it was going down my neck, and I was really worried about this, snow going down my neck.
I understand you complained about that at the time.
Probably. I think the next thing I was in the tent, and what I remember about being in the tent was wondering why my companions were talking about the dogs. And about this dog in particular, Jed, who probably saved my life, I think, because, well, what happened? The dogs got across the crevasse, as I understand it, and the sledge fell down, and they started dragging the dogs backwards, and the trace, the centre trace, made a groove in the far side of the crevasse, and eventually this dog, Jed, was pinned across, you know, like this, and was holding the sledge up and preventing it from going further down. And I think the other dogs just seized on this opportunity to attack him and damage him fairly badly. And I think that my colleagues were trying, deciding whether it was possible to save him and what they should do and all of this sort of thing. And I wondered why they were doing this. I mean, I didn't put two and two together. And from that time onwards, I think I drifted in and out of consciousness for some days. I don't know really how long it was.
It took over a week for the docs to get to you.
Even longer than that, I would have thought, but I'm not... You know, I've not looked at any records to prepare for this. I mean, this is just my memories. I would have thought it was more than a week, but what I was aware was the attention which I got from my colleagues. I mean, they were absolutely marvellous. I mean, they really were. I mean, not only attending to my real needs, like having my head sewn up and all of that sort of thing, and trying to make me as physically as comfortable as possible, but trying to encourage me. You know, I'd lost my appetite and I didn't find sledging rations very attractive. And all of a sudden, things like, you know, tins of mandarin oranges started appearing. You know, oh, I just happened to have this in the bottom of my personal bag. You know, you might like that. You know, and they're absolutely marvellous. I mean, they really were. I really felt... It was mainly subsequently, but I think at the time also, a deep sense of the relationship of men to one another. I mean, it was really, really very strong. And then, I was left with Ron Tyndall for several days whilst the others went off to get on with their business and also to guide Neil Orr to the accident site. And Ron Tyndall again, I mean, he took great effort to keep me interested in life, you know, to jolly me along, in other words, not let me sink into any slough of despond. I mean, I don't know whether I would have done, but I mean, I remember it very, very clearly. And there was one occasion when we had a particularly lovely sunset, and he encouraged me to crawl to the front of the tent to look at it, and he was standing some yards away from the tent, and he was waving his ice axe or something like that, and he suddenly began to disappear, as I remember it. He just sort of went down like that, and he was standing on the soft bridge of a crevasse, I think. He suddenly started to go down it. So, I mean, that could have had unfortunate consequences. Again, that's just my memory, but it seems quite clear to me now. So Neil Orr arrived. He decided that he couldn't do anything. I think that he thought that Ron had done quite a good job on my head under the circumstances. He didn't want to reduce the dislocation, because there was some danger of trapping the ulnar nerve between the two bones, and he would prefer to have an X-ray done. And I mean, I don't know if at that time he knew that the Argentinians had an X-ray machine, or whether he thought they might have, or whatever. But I think that was his reason for not doing anything at the time. And Keith Allen had used an old mattress from View Point and a couple of planks of wood to make a sort of ambulance sledge. They asked me if I'd be prepared to travel back on that. I didn't really have much choice, but so I was loaded on that, and Neil dosed me up with Nembutal or something like that. So I was barely conscious, and I was quite warm in a sleeping bag and a mattress underneath me. And so they began the process of getting me back to base. And I seem to remember that it was only minutes after starting that journey that the sledge went into another crevasse, this time just one runner, and it tipped over on its side like that, and they had to pull me out. Then I think there was
your thought at that moment?
I don't think anything, really. I mean, because I was, under the influence of a drug, a painkiller, and sedative. And I mean, I just accepted thing. I do remember having one thought about my possible future, but that was much later on. I'll come to that. And it was a fairly typical journey back to base. We had one period of very bad weather where we had to lie up. There was also open water in the channel, which meant that we couldn't travel up on the sea ice all the way as we would like to have done. So we had to go over a peninsula, James Ross Island, and up the ice fall at the head of a Holestricky Bay. That was quite hairy, and there were lots of crevasses there. And somehow the sledges got separated, and there was just Ron Tyndall driving my sledge, when suddenly we came to a shuddering halt. I remember the sledge tipped on its side and started slipping down another crevasse. And the runners were against one side, and I was against the other, and my head was like this, against the other side of the crevasse. I could feel the ice on my face, and the sledge began slipping down, and I could feel it sort of like sandpaper on my face. And through the corner of this eye, I could see just a black hole. It was really a quite deep crevasse. And silence, absolute silence. So I said, "Ron, are you there?" No reply. "Ron, are you there?" No reply. "Ron!" "Yes," he said, "I'm here." I said, "Where are you?" "I'm on the end of my fucking rope," he said. "Can you get out?" "No, I can't fucking get out." "So, what are you going to do?" "I don't know." So anyway, he climbed up his rope somehow and got out of this crevasse, by which time everybody else had arrived. There was then a very protracted discussion about what they were going to do, whether they were going to use another team of dogs to try and pull the sledge out, whether they would unlash the sledge and unpack it, pulling me off first, and then everything else. And all this time, I could feel the sledge slipping down, but eventually they just manhandled me out, and that was okay. And they got me off the sledge and sat me on a knob of rock. And in a way, I don't know, what do people say about other people? I would like to just say a little story about Neil here. I mean, this is the sort of situation that Neil revels in, I think. His nickname on bass, I don't know if anybody told you, was the father figure, because he presented himself as a rather, he was older and well-educated and the doctor and so on, and was a rather superior figure. And you know, this almost the situation that he'd been trained for, you know, because he then put his hand in his back pocket and he pulled out a silver hip flask and he said, "Oh, like a tortian," and I said, "No thanks, Neil," and his face seemed to crumple when he said, "Oh," he said, "Well, anything that can get you." I said, "Well, I wouldn't mind a bar of chocolate and a cigarette." "Oh, all right," he said.
"Were you refusing the rum on physiological grounds?"
No, I just didn't want it. I mean, you know, under the situation, I just didn't feel. I don't know whether it was rum or whiskey, but I just didn't. It was probably about 10 o'clock in the morning.
It was rum.
Yeah, it was rum. just didn't. Oh, he mentioned it, didn't he? Oh, right. Well, I hope our accounts are somewhere close. So anyway, we then set off. It was fairly normal until we got to within striking distance of viewpoint, when it was getting dark, and they said to me, "Well, what would you like to do? Ian, would you like to press on, and we'll get to viewpoint in the dark today? Or shall we camp now and finish in the daylight?" Well, I'd run out of cigarettes, so I said, "Oh well, let's press on." I think Keith Allen was driving the sledge. I'm not sure, and it really was quite dark. I think there was no moon; there were stars, and somehow we either missed the ramp from the sea ice up onto the ice foot, or its position had changed, or I don't know, but there was a lot of brash ice at the juncture between the sea ice that we were travelling on and the land ice, and suddenly the dogs and the sledge were floundering in water. And that's when I had this thought that I mentioned to you. I can remember thinking to myself, "God, have I got so far and I'm going to drown?" Because I could feel, you know, the water was coming up. I think I had a wet bottom and so on. And I mean, it really did look quite serious. But anyway, they managed to get me out. And on the whole, the story had a happy ending.
Well, except you still had a dislocated arm. They had to x-ray you. Now, the Argentinians did have an x-ray machine.
It was in pieces, in boxes. So there was some delay whilst they put it together and tested it, I suppose. And then I went down and had this x-ray and they took a photograph and they hung it out to dry and it then froze. And I did have the x-ray for quite a long time with the remains of ice crystals in it. I mean, it must be one of few that existed like that. But I think eventually I took a photograph of it and then threw the actual x-ray away. But, I mean, it seemed to show that it was a simple dislocation. And Neil, again, with the help of Ron Tyndall, I think, reduced it. I suppose he had to anaesthetise me. I can't remember whether he injected me with something. But by that time, there'd been quite a lot of fibrosis. And I think I remember other people saying that when they actually sort of broke through the fibrosis, there was a snap like a pistol shot. And I'm sure somebody said to me that Ron Tyndall fainted, but whether that was true or not, I don't know. So anyway, I mean the dislocation was reduced, but I was left with very limited mobility. But then the main sledging program was then about to begin, and so everybody went off base except for John Cheek, the wireless operator, and myself, and Neil left me with a series of exercises to do on the elbow to try and increase the mobility and strengthen the arm and so on. I mean, I've got tremendous muscle wastage up here, but I mean, I've been left with very restricted motion, that's it. He arranged for me to see a consultant at Thomas's Hospital when we got back to England. And this man's advice was not to do anything. He said, I can operate and straighten it out, but I wouldn't be able to guarantee that you'd be free of pain afterwards and that arthritis would not set in. So I chose to do nothing, and I mean, I just lived with it ever since.
Is it painful now?
No.
Arthritis?
No.
Just restricted movement?
Yes, restricted. But I mean, where I get pain is if I try and carry a suitcase in that arm, because you know the arm won't straighten. But
what use was the one-armed man at the base? What were you doing to earn your crust?
Well, I'm keeping the base running, and John and I, we ran it very much as we would have done with a base load of people, I mean, which meant, you know, weekly scrub outs, doing the Met. We'd been left with, I think, half a dozen puppies which needed weaning. We didn't have any seal meat, so I used to go out and try and shoot birds for them with one arm. Bit difficult, you know, that sort of thing. Nothing special, really. It was just surviving. It was quite a long time. I think it was several weeks. I'm not exactly sure, but one just had to do what was necessary.
Did that experience change your attitude towards the Antarctic as well?
No.
Towards life? Did it make life more valuable?
Well, I suppose so, but I mean, one thing that it did develop and encourage was a much more positive relationship with my fellow men. I mean, I realised how deeply I appreciated them. I mean, not just because for what they'd done for me, but just as people. And I think, you know, that's been the same ever since. I mean, it really was. It made it a much more life-enhancing experience than it would have done otherwise. Although, you know, maybe quite a hard way to achieve that.